Welcome to our show this morning. We're going to be picking up where we left off in our last show. We were discussing the New International Commentary of the New Testament, and we're doing a review, and the PDF is available online at our website, as was announced in the opening part of this segment. So we're going to do a very quick review of what we did last time so we can connect it in. We're going to be on page 3 of the PDF, and I'm going to be starting at the top so that you can understand the parts that we've covered and what we're going to do today. So right at the beginning, it says, Paul, while his attitude to the law provides scope for a rich variety of interpretations and doctrinal dissertations, uses language about freedom from the law, and then he puts in parentheses Galatians 5. We addressed that last week and came to the determination that that has nothing to do with freedom from the law. Then he goes on later on in that text, under his and Peter's guidance, the New Testament church found it necessary to abandon the Old Testament food laws as binding on all Christians. There he gives two passages that are in parentheses. The first one is Acts 11, 2 through 10, which we addressed last week. And the second one is Romans 14, 14, which we addressed the previous week, and we will readdress briefly today with more information to help you understand what was going on in that particular passage. This first paragraph on page 3 of the PDF that's on the website that's come out of the commentary that this particular professor wrote, we have addressed those pieces of it. Now we're moving in to the second paragraph. So let me start by reading that. But the view that Matthew regarded all Old Testament laws, presumably including the sacrificial and food laws, that's in parentheses, as still binding regulations for the conduct of Yeshua's disciples not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament and of subsequent Christian thinking, but also conflicts with clear pointers within his own gospel. Now, I would explain that, but I'm going to come back to it. I want to read the next sentence. In 15:11, Yeshua will make a pronouncement which, in effect, undercuts the whole complex of the Levitical laws of purity. And in the verses which will immediately follow this section, we will see Yeshua taking issue in various ways with a literal observance of the law as regulation. Now, that part's not going to be covered today, but we're going to be covering the first part that deals with Matthew chapter 15, verses 11. So let me go back at the beginning of that second paragraph, and let's take it a little bit at a time. At the top, we saw that he's got the freedom of the law thing working and the abandonment of the food law thing working. So now we're going to deal with it from within the Matthew gospel itself. The first sentence of the second paragraph says, but the view that Matthew regarded Old Testament laws as still binding regulations for the conduct of Yeshua's disciples. Where does he get that from? He gets it from Matthew 5:17, which this is the section, if you go to the commentary, whether you go to it as like I go to it with Logos, so there's no page number, but it is the section 5:17, and there's a discussion where he's between 17 and 18, in which Matthew is quoting Yeshua about, I haven't come to lessen the requirements of Torah. I've come to make clear what the requirements of Torah are, and there'll be no changes until heaven and earth pass away. That's 17 and 18. Now, this particular commentary, this particular author, I get the impression that he has a problem with that, and that's why he's quoting all of these standardized verses that have been quoted for almost two millennia to support that there is no law, and that includes no food laws. Of course, from my position, that's all bogus, because I was in Protestant Christianity for over 25 years, and I finally got out and started looking at what the scripture actually said and came to a different answer, and that's what I'm sharing. So, we're now at the second paragraph of page 3 and the first sentence. And we just read through it, but the view that Matthew regarded all Old Testament laws as still binding not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament. So, in other words, he's giving the passages up at the top. Runs counter to Galatians 5. No, it doesn't. runs counter to Romans 14, 14? No, it doesn't. Runs counter to Acts 11, 2 through 10? No, it doesn't. You see where the problem is here? And I covered all those. So that is already, that evidence has been presented to the court. Yes, that's correct. It's already there. So, taking that first sentence, but the view that Matthew regarded all Old Testament laws as still binding not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament, I disagree, and of subsequent Christian thinking, which I totally agree. Beginning in the second century, when the religion known as Roman Catholic or Roman Catholicism, when that began to be formed in the second century, they were supportive of removing the food laws. They were supportive of getting rid of a whole lot of laws. I'm actually going to mention a couple in today's presentation, in today's broadcast. But I digress. He breaks that sentence into that two parts, and so I want to make sure we're clear. Still binding regulations for the conduct of Yeshua's disciple not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament, wrong, and of subsequent Christian thinking, correct, but also conflicts with clear pointers within his own gospel. So we're back at this situation where Matthew is just making this up on the fly. He's just kind of decided, well, you know, I think I'm going to have Yeshua be Torah observant, but over here I'm going to have him throw away the Torah. Really? I don't think that's how it works when you're quoting a situation. Oh, but let's get into that next sentence. This is the second sentence of the second paragraph. We're going to read enough of it so to understand what we're doing. He's already said conflicts with clear pointers within his own gospel. Then he says in the next sentence, in 15:11, Yeshua will make a pronouncement which, in effect, undercuts the whole complex of the Levitical laws of purity. Really? Then I think we need to go ahead and take a look, because when I read it, that's not what I see at all. So this is where we're starting. That is our review, not only of what we've covered in previous broadcasts, but that is our review of the commentary text so that we have a launching point to get started. Here we go. We're going to be looking at Matthew 15, but I also want to mention that there is a parallel account in Mark 7. And what I like about this is that a whole lot of the stuff is exactly the same, but then each one brings to the table a part that the other one doesn't have. For example, this is just as an example, Mark, writing to possibly Gentiles, there is some discussion that his gospel was more toward Gentiles, needed to supply additional information about certain Jewish customs and traditions that Matthew doesn't need to, because Matthew's gospel is written to an audience that were mostly Jewish. So if he's writing to mostly Jewish, they already know these things. He doesn't have to mention them. If Mark is writing to a mostly Gentile audience, then he could have easily felt that he needed to put this in to help them understand a little bit of context for them, since they were not brought up from birth in observing all of these rituals, all of these traditions. They may not even have heard of all of them. So, in that sense, Mark is going to bring some additional information about other traditions, very general statement, but other traditions that are within the same scope as the tradition that Yeshua is addressing in Matthew 15 and Mark 7. Now, on the Matthew side, we know that the disciples are there. So there's three different things that take place, three different groups, three different locations that are within the Matthew 15, Mark 7 narrative. We know the disciples are there. Interestingly, Matthew identifies one of the disciples. Mark does not identify any of them. Matthew identifies Peter. And in the third telling, that's probably not the best way to say it, but I'm just going to use that for now. And when we get there, I'll bring that to bear, because you'll hear me talk about the fact that Peter is there. Peter is the one who asks for Yeshua the third time to explain it to them so they understand what he's trying to say. So Mark brings a little additional information concerning the sect of Pharisee Judaism, And this subset, which is what we're dealing with, a subset of the sect of the Pharisees. And Matthew lets us know that one of the disciples that was there at this particular meal was Peter. These are things that are going to be important as we get further down the road, so I wanted to bring that out. So having said all that, the reason I wanted to do that was because I want to use them together so that I can present a picture that includes what both of them report as we walk through that meeting. In the study that we're doing today, many questions will be asked and answered. There's one particular question I'd like to start with. In these two parallel accounts of this event, what was the purpose of Yeshua's teaching? The answer that you give to that could be very telling. Before we get to the questions that arise from his teaching here, let's take a step back and ask. The Torah, the prophets, the writings, also referred to by many as the Old Testament, speak many things concerning the signs that will enable people to determine if a particular individual is actually the one Moses wrote about, as Philip says to his brother in John 1:45. There's a lot of things Yeshua did. There's no question. I want to focus on a particular one because it's directly related to our study of Matthew 15, and as a secondary point, Mark 7. I want to ask and focus on this question. As regards the Torah, and this is the question I'm making up, as regards the Torah, law of God, the primary mission of this anointed one that was prophesied, multiple prophecies, multiple statements, probably should do a broadcast on that, probably. As regards the Torah, the law of God, the primary mission of this anointed one was, and I have four choices. The primary mission of this anointed one was to do away with the entire law. Number one, the primary mission as regards the Torah and the law of God was the primary mission of this anointed one to do away with the entire law. Was that the primary mission? Let's go to number two. These are the four questions I'm asking as we get started here. Number two, as regards the Torah, law of God, was the primary mission of this anointed one to do away with at least some of the laws, such as the food laws, things that relate to the Sabbath, all of the appointed times that were established in Genesis 1:14 and Leviticus 23. The primary mission of this anointed one was to get rid of those laws. Is that true? That's number two. Number three, as regards the Torah, law of God, was the primary mission of this anointed one to be like Moses? In other words, looking at Deuteronomy 18:15-18, the statement, I will raise up for them a prophet. So was this anointed one to be a prophet? I will raise up for them a prophet like you, Moses, from among their brethren. So that sounds like the brethren, that would be the 12 tribes, and Yeshua of the tribe of Judah. And the text in Deuteronomy continues, and will put my words in his mouth. So that means that this individual who's going to speak is going to be speaking the words of God. Whatever he says is what God would say, because God put his words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. So he is going to not withhold any information that he's told to speak. You remember, like in the U.S. court system here in the year 2020, it's, do you swear to tell the truth? But then the second part is the whole truth. Well, that's what's mentioned here. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will speak to them all that I command him. All right, this is number three. Was the primary mission of this anointed one to be a prophet with a prophetic ministry like Moses from his brethren, and who will speak all the words that God will put in his mouth? Interestingly, John records for us in chapter 7:16-17, my doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. Definitely a worthwhile study. But let's continue with just a few other points of interest. Isaiah 42, that's called the servant of Yahweh. And in 42:21, it says, magnify the Torah and make it honorable. Now, I have read other scholars who have said that has nothing to do with Yeshua. God is saying that he's going to make the he's going to magnify the Torah and make it honorable. But here's my thinking. I'm just connecting dots here. That's all I'm saying. This is a question. Believe it or not, yes, this is a question. When something is put under a microscope today, it is magnified so it can be seen better. Is that not true? When something is put under a microscope, it's magnified so it can be seen better. Well, what does the active voice of the verb fulfill in Matthew 5:17 do? It makes it clearer. It can be seen better, understood more clearly. So in the prophecy of Isaiah 42:21, magnify the Torah. If the servant of Yahweh is going to magnify the Torah, how would he do that? He would magnify it so that it can be seen better, and the active voice of the verb, that's exactly what it's talking about. I just thought that was interesting. Fits the facts. Another thing within this number three, primary mission, bring the Torah to the Gentiles. There's several passages that deal with that. I'm not going to mention them here, but there are passages that talks about bringing the instruction, bringing the law of God to the Gentiles, and they get to take hold of the covenant. Once again, it would be a fantastic study. But the fourth and final question, as regards the Torah, law of God, the primary mission of this anointed one was to help untangle misinterpretations, oral and written. Now, for this one, I want to quote rabbinical authorities directly. In a document that they authored called Genesis Rabbah, this is what it says when it gets to Genesis 49, which, if you remember, Genesis 49 deals with Yaakov giving a prophecy for all of his kids. And in 11 and 12, here's the statement about Judah. And what tribe was Yeshua from? Judah. He washes his garments in wine, intimates that the Messiah will compose for them words of Torah, and his vesture in the blood of grapes, that he will restore to them their arrows. How incredible is that? So, the rabbis themselves have written in their own rabbinical writings that a role of the Messiah is to restore to them correct understanding of Torah from their errors where they have misinterpreted it. So, going back to the beginning of this presentation, it was about what was the purpose of Yeshua's teaching? What if the purpose was to restore to them the truth about ritual purity and its role within the life of the believer and correct where they have gotten things out of balance? How interesting would that be? All right, so let's summarize my four questions. As regards the Torah, law of God, the primary mission of this anointed one was to do away with the entire law, was to do away with at least some of the law, like food laws, Sabbath, appointed times, was to be a prophet with a prophetic ministry like Moses, who will speak only and all the words of God and will magnify the Torah so that it will be more clear and will bring the Torah to the Gentiles. Four, will help untangle misinterpretations, oral and written. So based on what you choose here is going to be like presupposing a certain outcome. Everything you read is then going to go through that filter. So if you come to the text with, oh, I can tell you the primary mission of Yeshua, he came to do away with the entire law. If that is your choice of the four, that's number one, if that's your choice, that means that everything that you read is going to go through that filter and you're going to be looking for statements that you can then pop out and quote that talk about doing away with the law. And that's the danger of that. So we may mention those again, but I wanted to make sure I got them on record in the first segment here. Concerning the writer of this commentary, it would appear that he supports at least number two, cancel some laws, like maybe food laws. I mean, that's what we're talking about today. He's given some examples of where it says, in his understanding, that food laws have been done away with. Of course, we've gone through two, and now we're going to go through number three of the ones that he's given. The first two didn't hold any water, so now we're going to look at this one. There is the possibility that he would vote for number one, that the primary mission of the Anointed One was to cancel all the laws of God. Now, he hasn't said that. I mean, I haven't seen that sentence using those words in that order. But some of the things that he has, like, hinted at make me go, You ever been around those things that make you go, Well, that's where I'm at. So, no judgment here, but it appears that at least number two is a consideration, and number one might be more accurate. We'll have to see. But for now, we're going to stay focused on the food law reference in the commentary. Really got to keep this reined in because I got a lot to talk about and I only have 50 minutes to do it. One of the things that I want to share with you before we close out this segment is that if he is a supporter of number one, and I think number two falls within this too, he's not alone. So I'm going to read you three quotes so that you can just get an idea of where he might be standing. Here's the first quote. Jesus is here not only annulling the rabbinical development of kashrut, but is setting aside the written law. That's number one. Number two, Jesus' teaching not only takes issue with a major feature of traditional Jewish religious practice, but also rescinds a major body of Old Testament material dealing with such ritual laws. That's number two. Number three, these are all famous scholars, by the way. I'm going to tell you about them in a second. And of course, the information to them is on the website. And number three, in verses 6 through 13, Jesus equated the Mosaic law with God's word and scolded the Pharisees for nullifying God's word with their tradition. Now Jesus himself is nullifying God's word with regard to food. But it is the prerogative of Jesus as God's son to change the law. That's where we're going to stop in this segment, and we're going to pick it up on the other side of the half hour as soon as we can. Thank you. Okay, so here we are. We're going to pick up where we left off. We had just done three quotes hopefully, you were like, really? People actually said that? Yes, I'm not good enough to make that up. So that's where we're starting off. Now, I want to talk about what's been going on in the last 40 years. There's been a reassessment as regards Protestant Christian theology. I'm going to say that the kickoff took place in 1977 with E.P. Sanders, Paul and Palestinian Judaism. As we've mentioned in the past, the view of Paul with Judaism in the first century, Luther termed himself the second Paul, and that the Roman Catholic Church was Judaism. Of course, that missed the mark just a little. Then there was the revolt, which brought out the protesting reformers, people who wanted to reform the Catholic Church. Didn't work out, so they started their own religion. So, moving forward, what Luther said took hold, even though a lot of people didn't agree with it, it still took hold. Then, as people continued to press the mark about how bad Judaism was in the first century and how everything needed to be upended and destroyed and blah, 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 just, you know, causes your ears to bleed. One gentleman, E.P. Sanders, came along and he said, "You have got this thing entirely wrong." And so in 1977, he wrote his book, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, and it turned Christian theology on its head. So moving out of that, anybody who wanted to talk about the New Testament, and especially Paul, had to be able to take his arguments into consideration. And because he had a mastery of the rabbinic literature and understood Second Temple, that was quite the task. Nevertheless, people have stepped up to the plate. In 1982, James Dunn came along. I believe he was speaking in Durham in England. He coined the phrase, the new perspective of Paul. It was Paul versus Judaism. Then for a short time, it was Paul and Judaism. And now it's Paul within Judaism. It's required a completely rereading of all of Paul's letters and other writings that are part of the apostolic collection to reevaluate Paul within the Judaism of the time. And we even talked about that a little bit in Romans 14, because that's an intra-Judaic debate and what's going to take place in our discussion and what took place in the Matthew 15, Mark 7 story narrative is an intra-Judaic debate where Yeshua comes and, according to my four questions, does number four. He straightens out some things and gets things back to balance. You'll see that when we get there. So, these different ones have come forward, and that's just, you know, that's just the start. Sanders and Dunn. Then N.T. Wright is like a supercharger on this new perspective of Paul. He's blowing up everything around the world. And then P.J. Thompson, also Paul and the Jewish Law, Halakha to the Gentile Churches. There's a lot of things in there that we can take note of. That's probably going to be one that we're going to review at some time in the future. And I'm even going to mention them within the discussion of the Matthew 15:11, which was taken from the commentary, which we're reviewing. So there's a lot of pieces here, and I just want to make sure that I mention these gentlemen because they bring so much to the table, and they have helped me so much with understanding, trying to get out of my old mindset and look at things again, listen to what is written again, and then place it within the context of first century Judaism. All right, there are some pieces that I feel like will help us. And one of those, we are going to be talking about the food laws because this is how the author of the commentary reviewing refers to that. But I want to bring out a point. I want to mention a point so that we can be sure that this is not left on the side of the road. But it is important. Yes, there are instructions concerning what is clean and what is unclean. You can read Leviticus 11. No question. It's there. That's what the text says. But I also want to bring to attention about the national holiness piece. And I think that's important. And I have a little bit of evidence that will help you see what I'm trying to speak to. That the quote-unquote food laws, it goes further than that. It actually goes into the national holiness, being set apart to the Most High. One of the ways that you can see this is with the Maccabees and Antiochus IV. In that history, what you'll know, and you can see this in 1 Maccabees, is that they were being told that they had to consume what was called unclean. And they refused to do it. So in 1 Maccabees 1:62, they chose to die rather than to be defiled by food or to profane the Holy Covenant. So there, both of the pieces are in place. There is the food part, and then there's the profaning the covenant. And they took it very seriously, and they chose to die instead of being obedient. And we're going to talk about that down the road, because that took place later on as Christianity came into existence, and then they started requiring people to do certain things after Sunday service. And if they didn't, they put them to death. But we'll get to that history. That's just a little bit down the road. All right, continue with that. There is a story in 2 Maccabees 7 where a mother and her seven sons were executed because of their refusal to eat pork. That's just straight up. Let me read it again. A mother and her seven sons were executed. Let me say it again. A mother and her seven sons were executed because of their refusal to eat pork. That's 2 Maccabees 7. The oldest son declared, "For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws." And there were others. 4 Maccabees, chapter 5. This gentleman, Eleazar, chose torture and death rather than eat pork as Antiochus IV had decreed. So, you know, there's some stuff there. This is a major thing. And you know what happened? You know what came out of this? The non-biblical feast called Hanukkah. We know Hanukkah because Yeshua celebrated it in his day, according to John. I'll mention that in a moment. What took place in the first century was an annual recognition of these who stood strong. And needless to say, that must have been some major thing to stand up. I'm not going to eat the other white meat. You can go ahead and torture and kill me, but I am not going to profane the covenant. That is standing hard and fast. So in the time of the first century, if we look at other sects like the Dead Sea Scroll group, they also recognized these pieces as very important. Let's go ahead and get to our next section here now. I want to go ahead and start by reading the text. As I said, I would be combining Matthew and Mark together. So this is how we're going to proceed. I'm going to read the text, and then we're going to talk about it. Here we go. "Then came together unto him," that would be Yeshua, "the Pharisees and certain of the scribes, which came from Jerusalem. When they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled," but the Greek word there is common. So let me read that again. "When they saw some of his disciples eat bread with common," that is to say with unwashen hands, "they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands a lot, they don't eat, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the market shopping, except they wash, they don't eat. And many other things there be which they have received, and they hold on to, washing of cups, pots, brazen vessels, tables, etc. So they then say to Yeshua, 'Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread.'" So that is the first set of texts. So that's the beginning of what is taking place here. And don't forget, I open this with, what was the purpose of Yeshua's teaching at this meal and, of course, after the meal? All right, so let's go back and break these verses down. Pharisees and scribes, they came, and needless to say, this was some type of scenario in which they're having a meal. Is it outside? I don't know. Could be outside, because later on they go into a house. That's in part three of this section. So I'm not sure, but it says that they saw that some of his disciples eat bread with common, that is, hands that had not been washed, and they found fault. Now, what I appreciate in the next two lines is there is a help me. Help me understand more about this and their traditions and what they do. And so it talks about the fact that they wash their hands a lot or they don't eat, and they're continually holding to the tradition. And when they go shopping in the market, they have to go through a mikvah or they don't eat, because they feel like just going shopping, they have picked up corpse level impurity. And so they need a mikvah to be able to handle it. So that's in that too there. And then, of course, the last one is they found fault and they turn to Yeshua and say, why did they transgress the tradition of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. Now, going back to the second verse there, the word is common. That's what is used. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with common, that is to say, hands that have not been washed. So what we need to do is we need to have a little bit of understanding of what this is discussing there. So I want to give you a breakdown from their perspective. I would say that at issue is a Jewish practice of ritual hand washing. It's called Nilet Yadayim. That is N-T-I-L-A-T and then Y-A-D-A-Y-I-M. Even in people's homes, they observe this. And there's nothing wrong with washing your hands. I wash my hands before a meal. I just do, because I figure I picked up dirt. But it's not the same. They are dealing with something that is not in Torah, and we're going to break that down. But let me continue with this explanation. It's based on an idea that we're the temple of the Most High. You've heard that somewhere. Our table in the house where we eat is the altar. Our food is the sacrifice, and that we are priests of the Most High who are always required to serve in a ceremonially pure state. But that's not true. The priests at the tabernacle, at the temple, need to be ritually pure to receive and consume the sacrifices that the people bring, yes. But to extend that to all the people, no. It's a tradition of the elders. Now, if you do this, as far as I know, there's no problem. But if you require others to do it and condemn them for committing a sin because they don't do it, you know what it reminds me of? There was the lighting of the candles as Shabbat is beginning, and there are some oral traditions that list as, we're going to light the candles because it's commanded of God. No, it's not. It's not commanded anywhere of God to light the candles to begin Shabbat. It's an oral tradition. Some people do it. As far as I know, there's no problem lighting candles prior to eating Shabbat meal. But it's not commanded. So if you were to condemn someone for not doing that, guess what that's called? That's called a violation of Deuteronomy 4:2. Do not add and do not take away. You have added to the Torah because you've told them they have to light candles because it's commanded by God, and it's not. So in the washing of hands, it says they found fault. But here's the problem. It's not in the Torah. And we're going to connect this, but you need to understand their thinking, and that's what is important for me to present right now. Continuing with my thoughts there, there is, from the Talmud, it says, Rabbi Judah said in the name of Rab, some say it was taught in a teaching, sanctify yourselves, which is actually in Leviticus 11:44. But their interpretation is this refers to washing of the hands before the meal. So they have taken a Torah statement, sanctify yourselves, and they have redefined it to mean washing your hands before a meal. See how this is going? And then there's another text in Torah that says, be ye set apart. And then they reinterpret that to mean this refers to washing of the hands after the meal. So what happens here is that if you don't do this, then if they're keeping the tradition of the elders, you're not. That's a problem for them, and I'm going to explain why. Do you remember when we discussed Romans 14:14? It says, I have been assured by Yeshua HaMashiach that nothing is common of itself. Now, your text was unclean, but as you saw, that was a mistranslation of the Greek word there. It's not unclean. As a matter of fact, if you go back and look at the time in Hebrew in which unclean is used throughout the entire Torah, writings, and prophets, it is never translated into the Greek as common. So this is not talking about that which is unclean. That's what people want to say so that they can say that nothing's unclean of itself. But that is not what the text says. It says something is common. There is a difference in understanding when it comes to ritual impurity. And that is something that we're going to have to cover. But first, before we get there, I need you to understand how they're thinking. So what I have done is I have pulled together three quotes from the Mishnah that deal with this concept. I think the best way to describe the concept would be a derived impurity. We'll talk more about that as we head down the road. But first, you can access all three of these Mishnah portions because I've put the link in a document on my website so that you can go and read it. But I'm going to read it now. The first one is Mishnah Javin, chapter 5, point 12. This is the disqualification. One who eats food with first-degree uncleanness. One who eats food with second-degree uncleanness. One who drinks unclean liquids. A clean person who upon whose head a greater part of him there fell three logs of drawn water. A scroll, that's the Holy Scriptures, and unwashed hands. That disqualifies. Unwashed hands. That's Zavin 5.12. Next is Yadayim 3. We're going to read 1 and 2, I think. This is some crazy stuff, so stay with me. If a person puts his hands inside a house with scale disease, his hands have first-degree uncleanness, according to the words of Rabbi Akiba. But the sages say his hands have second-degree uncleanness. So, as you can see, I mean, right there, two sentences, you can see that, oh, they're not always in agreement. They don't have always unanimous understanding. No, you are correct, they don't. Whoever defiles garments at the time when he touches the uncleanness, he defiles hands so they have first-degree uncleanness, according to the words of Rabbi Akiva. But the sages say it's second-degree uncleanness. If, as you walk through here, is talking about these different types of first degree, second degree, sometimes third degree uncleanness within the oral understanding. And I'm going to read Romans 14 in a second so you can see how this fits. So this deals with the hands, and then in part two, anything which disqualifies defiles hands with a second degree uncleanness. One unwashed hand defiles the other hand, according to the words of Rabbi Joshua. But the sages say that which has second degree of uncleanness cannot convey second degree of uncleanness, which is the unwashed hands piece is a second degree of uncleanness. He said to them, but do not the holy scriptures which have second degree of uncleanness defile the hands? It does. They said to him, the laws of the Torah may not be argued from the laws of the scribes, nor may the laws of the scribes be argued from the laws of Torah, nor may the laws of scribes be argued from other laws of scribes. How about that? There's no way to defend a position or to discuss an opinion to see if it's right or to debate it. You just have to accept it because somebody said it and somebody wrote it down, and you can never even bring the Torah into it. You know that can't be right. So that was my second one. And then the third one is Mishnah Tahorot, T-A-H-O-R-O-T. This is 2:2, and it says, he who eats with first-degree uncleanness contracts first-degree uncleanness. He who eats with second-degree uncleanness contracts second-degree uncleanness. With third-degree uncleanness contracts third-degree uncleanness. Rabbi Joshua says, he who eats food with first-degree or second-degree uncleanness contracts second-degree uncleanness. Third-degree contracts second-degree uncleanness. Uncleanness. All this applies to common food that was prepared in condition of cleanness that is appropriate. So this and many more Mishnah and Talmudic references that will discuss ritual purity and how they have come to decisions about certain pieces of it, and this impacts the thinking. So now what we need to do is to go to Romans 14:14 and watch this in action. Paul says, I know and am persuaded by Lord Yeshua that there is nothing common of itself. But look what the rest of the verse says. That's only 14, verse 14a. Look at 14b. But if a person thinks it has a derived impurity, then to him it's impure. So this passage here and this chapter is talking about conscience and how you act. So he's saying, I am persuaded by Yeshua that nothing has a derived impurity of itself. It's not inherent. But if you think that has a derived impurity, then to you, it's impure, and you cannot eat it. Now, how do we know you cannot eat it? If we go over to Romans 14:23, he that doubteth is damned if he eat, because he eateth not of faith. So if he thinks within his conscience, he's convicted that this is unclean. It has received a second level. We'll call it second degree. We'll call it common. We'll call it derived impurity. I can't eat it. So let's go now to those verses to start off Mark and Matthew. What is taking place? Some of the disciples are not washing their hands. That means that they have a level of impurity. When they touch the bread, they will transfer that impurity to the bread. And now none of the subset of the sect of Pharisees who believe this oral tradition can eat, because they all are going to say, oh no, the bread is now defiled. Now Yeshua is going to come back later and say, no, it's not. But in the beginning of the story, the bread has become defiled because some of Yeshua's disciples didn't wash their hands. And according to the subset of the sect of the Pharisees, that caused the entire bread to become unclean, and therefore they can't eat it. And now they're upset, and rightfully so. In their mind, that was wrong because I'm hungry. So that gives you an idea of what was being faced there. Now, I've run out of time. We're going to pick this up in the next show, which will be next week. I think it's July 23rd. We're just going to continue right along because I thought I was going to get this all done and have some time left over. I've got a lot more to talk about, a lot more. So here we go. Thank you.